is, we're going to go ahead and, for purposes of testimony, go ahead and begin that we have less than a quorum for work session. A couple of members are excused, a couple others we hope are going to be able to join us here very shortly. As the proponents, I'm going to ask representatives of the Committee for Oregon Families, Pascal Phillips, and Pascal, I believe you wish to be joined by Ms. McFarland. If you'd like to, or anyone else, please feel free and introduce House Bill 2460 to us, please. And see, the Juvenile Rights Project, as always, is well prepared.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
However you wish to handle it, Pascal, in terms of the order, and we'll, unless there's a compelling reason to take questions, we'll wait until all three of you have had a chance, and then we'll go to our list of those who've signed up today.
Okay. Julie McFarlane, I'm the acting director of the Juvenile Rights Project. I'm also a member of the Committee for Oregon Families, and at least initially I'll be speaking on behalf of the committee. Fairly early on in our research concerning problems with the handling of children's custody cases in the state, the committee determined that there was a need for clarifying the law of standing regarding who could seek custody and visitation with children. There were a number of cases that were brought to our attention, and you will be hearing from some of these folks later, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about the facts of the cases, but basically we decided that we really wanted to do a bill that would clarify standing and grant standing to persons who under the current law are not clearly entitled to standing in custody cases. The bill, as printed and as it came back from Legislative Council, however, took one giant step beyond standing and goes into the issue of preference in custody. And that was further than the committee really intended to go. So today, attached to my testimony, is an amendment that we would propose to submit for the printed version of the bill. It is purely a standing provision. It does not get into preference as the current printed version of the bill does, and that is what we wanted to present to the legislature.
Okay, so on behalf, just so we understand here, on behalf of the proponents, we should, the printed bill, forget this,
right,
and just, this is the bill that we're proceeding with as far as you're concerned at this point.
That's
okay.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, now, referring to that bill, as it would be amended by that amendment, the Juvenile Rights Project supports providing standing for any person, including a foster parent, a step parent, or a relative who's established emotional ties creating a child-parent relationship with the child, to petition the appropriate court for custody, visitation, or other parental rights. The standing to sue doctrine sets general threshold requirements preventing certain persons from initiating litigation to challenge basically governmental action. A determination by a court that a person lacks standing to either initiate a proceeding or to intervene in an ongoing proceeding means that that person cannot have access to legal redress on that issue. The jurisdictional requirement of standing is founded on Article 3 of the United States Constitution and requires that there be a case or controversy before a court may entertain a case. The standing doctrine is primarily designed to promote judicial efficiency by cutting out cases where a grievance is too generalized, the injury is relatively slight, the case is hypothetical or abstract, or the case is collusive. The state law doctrine of standing is not as well developed as the federal law doctrine, although state law doctrine has clearly been influenced by federal case law. The predominant modern view at this point is that a prospective litigant threatened with possible harm or having a personal stake in the outcome should have standing in a case. Along that line, the Oregon Court of Appeals in Reflow versus Reflow-Siebert, which is attached to my testimony, approved the standing of non-parents as interveners in a custody case. In Reflow, two children had been in the physical custody of the father's sister and the father's brother-in-law for several years during and following a divorce. The Clackamas County Juvenile Court was involved in the case and early on, at the request of the parents, had made the children wards of the court and placed them with the sister and brother-in-law as legal guardians in Aberdeen, Washington. And I might add that this is probably a fairly unusual case because usually guardianship is not awarded by juvenile court in this sort of proceeding. I think probably the reason it was in this case was because the custodians were out of state and the court wanted to assure that it would retain jurisdiction over the case. Both the trial court and the Court of Appeals approved the sister and brother-in-law standing in the case based on their physical custody and the requests of the parents which had triggered the arrangement. Now, Reflow is being used in some cases, and there are a number of ongoing trial court cases in which non-parents have been granted standing in custody matters based on Reflow. However, if you look at that opinion, you'll see that it's not a very strong opinion in terms of standing, and the court does not discuss the standing issue at all and just approves what the trial court decided in Reflow. So while Reflow has opened the standing door for some non-parents seeking custody, it is an unusual ruling. It's a factually complicated case and thus does not provide adequate precedent for most cases and would probably be totally inapplicable in domestic relations and probate cases in which the issue of custody often arises. Nor would Reflow provide authority for initiating proceedings, since Reflow only dealt with intervening in a case, and as you know, intervention under the Oregon rules is quite permissive, and so it would be quite another matter in terms of initiating a proceeding to ask for or challenge custody. Clearly, there's no adequate remedy under current law for persons who have established a parental relationship with a child to prevent the severing of that relationship. For the reasons I have discussed and the testimony that you will hear a little later on from some of the individuals who have actually been involved in these kind of cases, we would urge you to adopt the amendment of the Committee for Oregon Families and to send House Bill 2460 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, again, why don't we hear from everyone and then we'll open up the questions. Pascal?
I am Pascal Phillips, Secretary of the Committee for Oregon Families. I'll try to keep from repeating what Julia said, but I want to make it more clear just what the typical case is and where the center of the problem is. The typical case is where someone has legitimately and lawfully established a parent-child relationship with a minor. Today we'll have three families here. One, a stepmother. One, a long-term foster parent. And one, relatives. The ordinary situation is a child is left with relatives or a mother. A woman marries a man who has small children in his custody as his natural children. Then when a divorce occurs years later, she has no standing at all. Behind this we have another problem, which will also explain why we amended the bill after it came out in that surprising form from legislative counsel, with twice as much in it as we asked to have. I will quote here from the CLE. Litigation often results, and the courts are bound by two competing doctrines, both of them backed by Oregon appellate cases. First doctrine is a fit parent has a right to custody of minor children unless there are compelling reasons depriving him or her of that custody. Cases are quoted. The second one is the best interest of the minor child is the governing criteria. And the best interest in the child includes stable and continuity and stability and continuity in family life. And there are an equal number of cases going the other direction. Now the court is faced with this difficulty. And our position is that faced with this, the court should have the right to hear everybody. But this is a tough decision. This is a hard decision. And the court should know all the facts and not have one important part of the facts they can't hear because the person has no standing. This will also explain why we amended the original. The original went beyond that to make suggestions to the court, you might say, preferences and so forth, and how they should decide it. We don't think the law is ready for that. We just want the court to hear all the facts. We want the court to know the whole story before it makes this gut-wrenching decision, a decision which has an enormous impact on the child. Now, as most of you know, the Committee for Oregon Families is a pragmatic-oriented group, and we have tended to use case studies. Our case studies have revealed many, many cases like this. We are not here looking at odd duck situations. This is an everyday tragedy going on. There are a couple of problems that might come up, which I think should be discussed. Number one is would it add an extra burden to the courts? It's true, there will be a few cases where extra parties are involved. But against that, you have to balance the fact that the extra parties are there because they will help the court to get the whole thing out on the table and make a decision. Furthermore, in the many cases which we have seen where the child is sent to the wrong home because the court could not hear the evidence as to where the child's emotional attachments really were, they end up coming back into court. That's the kid that runs away. That's the child that gets into trouble. That child has been forced into an unhappy home. It may come back under different titles. It may come back under different parts of the statute, but it comes back. It would have been far better and shorter to handle it in the beginning. A somewhat similar line of reasoning involves time. It is true that bogeymen can be invented where parties coming in as interveners will delay the time the child is placed. But if the child is placed in the right place, delayed, it's better than the wrong place, not delayed. The inadequacy of other remedies, I can only say that I agree with what Julie said, that Reflow, for instance, is a very shaky base. Other attempts we have seen have a ring of desperation about them. And our experience with case after case has been to see that regardless of such complex expedients, the fact is in the real world, most families are unable to get into court. They usually go from lawyer to lawyer and are told there's no use even taking a fee from you because we can't do you any good. We hear this all the time. Lastly, the function of the courts with the professional agency. A relatively small proportion of the children involved in this kind of case are involved with CSD. I say that specifically because most of us here, Committee for Oregon Families, and think CSD is close connection. Most of these children are involved in divorce cases and probate cases. In the case where CSD is involved, it is again essential that both the court and CSD have all the facts, not just one side. Both sides have the right to hear all the testimony before making the decision. We believe that that the families you will hear from today will explain it better than we can in a way, but I believe that this opening of standing is also in line with what's happening in many states around the country, and seems to work. So I hope you will pass this amendment, and thank you.
I'm Al Warblad, and I'm a member of Committee for Oregon Families, and I think they pretty well covered it. I would like to mention two areas. First, and to reiterate what Father Pascal said, is this mainly happens in divorce cases as opposed to neglect, abuse, or delinquency type cases. Usually you'll see it where it's a situation of a step-parent who in fact has raised the child and the actual custodial parent is inadequate. You'll see it in cases where both parents are generally inadequate to raise that child, but it doesn't rise to the level of a neglect or abuse case. And in fact, some other relative, generally a grandparent or generally a brother and sister, have in essence raised that child. And so these people who have raised the child, and probably one of the best examples is one I had this fall, man gets custody, moves up to Oregon, is married, I don't know, 10, 15 years, something like that, has a heart attack and dies. The stepmother raised the child. The next week, the natural mother came up and claimed the child, and the stepmother had no standing to file anything, and I had to return the child to California to a mother the child had probably not seen in 10 or 12 years. Really rather a tragic case. The second point I would like to make is that all the cases in Oregon, I think what we all want to do is look for the best interest of the child. And if the court cannot have that person who has raised the child or who has the most ties to the child in front of the court, and the court cannot consider that person for custody, then we are not considering the best interest of the child. And really, that's what this bill does. It allows the court to look and to determine the best interest of the child.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, if,
let me, for your information, Pascal, Julie, and Judge Norblad, we have had it suggested, I guess, in some other hearings on other bills that, and I don't mean necessarily to point the finger at CSD, but in certain groups in our society, ethnic groups, cultural groups, the family structure is different than Ozzie and Harriet or, you know, the Donna Reed kind of prototype that we kind of assume is the normal case, and that in fact for, quote, non-traditional families or for family situations that are different from the Donna Reed show, CSD and society generally has tended not to favor those kind of relationships, extended families, and that really, in fact, works against the best interest of the child who may come from those communities. Is that, would you generally concur with those observations as well?
I think that has been a problem. There is a federal law which does require consideration of placement with relatives. So that this bill allowing standing and opening up that consideration to the court is certainly consistent with that federal law as well.
Okay, thank you. Judge
Marlin? Probably our prime example here are the Russian Old Believers. We have a large community in the Woodburn, Jervis, Mount Angel area. I think when I went on the bench and when those people first started moving in, everybody had trouble dealing with them, including CSD. And I give CSD and everybody else credit because now we're starting to understand their culture, starting to accept it, attempting to blend our work within those people's society. It is a difficulty. But
I assume the same in the metropolitan area, Southeast Asian families, there's a fairly significant minority group in that community where I think the family ties are a little bit different than what we're used to, but are just as strong, if not stronger, as a result of that cultural background as well.
The Committee for Oregon Families includes representatives from the Hispanics and the Black community and the Vietnamese, and they have all observed this problem. and there happens to be one family will testify today where the problem does arise from a non-traditional family situation. So that kind of thing does happen.
Okay. Any further questions?
Well, I had one question. I just checking up on something.
Representative Phillips.
Unless you have asked my grandparent question.
No. Okay.
I was wondering, as proponents of the measure, including the words, including grandparents, so that although your definition would include them, I think there's been a number of years of discussion as to whether they needed to be stated or not stated specifically, and I just was wondering quickly what your opinion might be to specifically putting that wording in.
I do think that they are included in the way we drafted the bill. Certainly grandparents are one of the prime groups that we're thinking about with this legislation, and I don't think we would have any objection to clarifying that.
Since I read that into what you had said, that's why I was thinking about putting that wording in there, just laying it right out.
It says relative by blood or marriage.
Yeah, I understand that. But
we
sometimes
no
when you put the word in
specified.
There. Okay.
I have no problem with it. We have grandparent visitation. It's been in existence, what now, 6 years?
Okay. But the issue keeps coming back.
I finally had my first grandparent visitation case last week. Out of 6 years.
Step grandparents, Rip St. Phillips?
No step grandparents. That's not an issue that I'm concerned with. But if you wanted to put it in, Mr. Chair, I'm sure that we could look at it.
Any further questions?
I would like to add one footnote, though. One of the oddities of Oregon law is that step-parents by ORS 109.053 are required to take the fiscal and financial support of the stepchild. It does seem strange that a person who is required by law to support the child has no right or standing in court to come in and ask for visitation to the child.
Representative Miller and then Representative Phil.
I want to get a little clarification on that. I know you addressed it somewhat on what would establish the emotional ties creating a child-parent relationship with a child. What's
this is drafted to leave that decision up to the court to make a case-by-case decision. One of the things I think you'll be seeing when you hear the further testimony on this is that these cases vary a lot. And you can't really, we think, lay down a definition of what is going to constitute parent-child ties in every case. There are going to be cultural differences that are going to determine that in some cases. There are going to be necessity circumstances in some cases where, indeed, maybe the relationship isn't very long, but there's just not much else out there for that child, and you have to take advantage of this willing adult's relationship with that child while you can, and it's in the best interest of that child to do so. So that was our intent, to leave it to the discretion of the court. A person will come in with a motion for intervention or file a petition, and it's then up to the court to determine whether or not there's adequate child-parent ties in the individual case so that they can proceed.
In the main, I think we're talking about people who, in fact, have raised that child. The case where mom and dad leave the child with the grandparents or the sister or the brother and go off and do their thing and, in fact, don't raise the child. The other probably prime example is where the father or the mother who has custody of that child moves in with some relative. Generally, it's the grandparents of that child. And in fact, those grandparents raise that child while the parent, again, is out doing their thing but living in that house.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where in Chapter 109 does it really speak to the best interest of the child? Is that language... What statute is that? No, as long as it's there. I mean, I hear it, and sometimes it's disquieting when I don't see it as part of what we're doing, because it seems that gets lost in these types of issues. But this does relate back to that statute.
There's a statute which set, again, very broad, which sets out the criteria for child custody.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Bye. Any further questions? Okay, if not, thank you. We have Paul K. Harrison. And I believe, Mr. Harrison, we've received previously a copy of your written remarks, but we certainly want to give him an opportunity to review those comments or summarize them for us. And
summarize them for you.
Okay.
If you have any questions for me.
Thank you.
My name is Paul Harrison. You have the written version of my summary in front of you. My foster daughter was placed with us 3 years ago, and during that period of time, all I can describe it is that it seemed after a few months that she had always been there and had always been a daughter. Maybe my family is unique. All of our children are adopted, and we have integrated all of them into the family. In any case, at the end of 3 years, following some good views and differences of opinion with CSD, she was removed essentially overnight. There was no warning, no list of deficiencies in the home, no alleged deficiencies. We went through our case file afterwards. There are no deficiencies written down. On paper, there was no basis for the removal. We felt that they were very wrong in what they had done, because this child is totally physically handicapped, completely dependent upon somebody else to meet all of her needs in everything. The end result was we petitioned CSD to have her returned. They refused. We looked for some other agency or person that could review the situation from an unbiased viewpoint. At that point, we found there were none. We could not petition the courts. We talked to several attorneys. They said, take $4,000 or $5,000 and no guarantee that we will ever be heard by a court. We were lucky. Somehow the case was brought into court on behalf of the child. The end result was the judge listened to all sides of the story, and the child is now back with us. I felt we won, but we were lucky. Shouldn't have worked that way. We should never have been able to get that case into court. And if we've been anything but lucky, it would never work out. I would like to distribute to you the results of that court hearing. If you have any questions of me.
Mr. Harrison, just you may have mentioned this, but I missed it. How old was your foster daughter at the time this happened?
She was 12 when she joined our family. She was 14 when she joined.
And were you ever given a reason as to why the agency, apparently, or someone else felt this had to take place?
We were given several reasons over the telephone. And we responded to them by saying, the items that you're listing, you're misinformed. That way. And their response was, we feel it is. But it was never, according to their policies, you know, if you're going to terminate a long-term foster placement because of discrepancies in the family should be given at least a written list of why the child is to be removed and a chance to reply to them. It was never done. We had nothing, we had no way to use the grievance procedure because there was nothing to grieve.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Okay, if not, Mr. Harrison, thank you very much for your patience this afternoon, and your written comments are, of course, made a part of the record, and we're glad to hear that in your situation, at least, you were able to resolve it, but appreciate you coming forward with this. Okay, we have Ms. Darter?
Being a psychological parent and having nurtured a child for